Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Small Animal Surgery, Richard Meeson. Thank you, Richard. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this webinar on feline pelvic trauma. So the plan for this webinar is as follows. We're going to look at how we assess and triage these cats that have suffered pelvic trauma. Then we're going to look at some of the common urinary tract issues that can be concomitant with pelvic trauma, some of the neurological issues that can occur, and then we're going to specifically look at pelvic fractures, how to diagnose them, what decisions to make about when you should operate, when you shouldn't operate, and how to take that forward. And then we're going to sort of talk about some of the tips and tricks for doing pelvic fracture surgery. After that, we'll look at the post-op management. And then I've got an appendix at the end, which is going to be a step-by-step run-through of how to place a tube cystostomy. And then, of course, if there are any questions, I will do my best to answer them at the end. So I think first thing to say is that feline pelvic trauma is pretty common. I see it a lot in my practice, and I suspect you do as well. And these cats have sustained quite a lot of trauma. So it's important not to just focus on their orthopaedic injuries, but to make sure you check them over fully. So initially, it's important to do a primary survey and major body systems assessment. So that would include looking at the cardiovascular system. So we're going to auscultate for heart rate, for heart rhythm. It's important to look at the mucous membrane colour, capillary refill time, and feel their pulse and see what their pulse quality is like. Pelvic trauma often leads to quite significant bleeding, so these animals can be in hypovolemic shock. It's also important to check the respiratory system. Initially, you can just look at them, look at how fast they're breathing, what the characteristics of their breathing's like, have they got abdominal effort as well. And then it's important to systematically auscultate the thorax. And you're listening for lung sounds, and if there's a lack of lung sounds, then that may indicate that there's fluid or viscera or air in the thoracic cavity, which is obviously abnormal and may need further investigation. I'd also include in the major body systems assessment an abdominal assessment. Damage to the urinary tract is quite common with pelvic fractures, so it's quite important to early on determine if this could be the case. So if you can carefully palpate for a bladder and just check that you can fill an intact bladder. If you can't, it doesn't mean it's not ruptured, and if you can, it doesn't mean that there isn't an injury, but it's a good initial indication. It's also worth checking for continuity of the body wall. It's quite easy to miss these sometimes. If you feel along the back of the most caudal ribs, sometimes you may be able to feel emphysema, some gas pockets underneath the skin, or even lumpy sort of areas which could be viscera that have gone through a tear. And another common place it tends to be in the inguinal region or at the prepubic tendon. When you're feeling the abdomen, consider, does it feel normal to you for this cat, or does it feel a bit empty? If it feels a bit empty, it could be that there's a diaphragmatic rupture and the contents of the abdomen are somewhat in the thoracic cavity, and that could explain that. It's also really important to do, certainly at this stage, a brief neurological examination. So when the cat's presented, does it seem normal? Has it got normal mentation, or is it comatose, or unduly quiet? Is it able to walk, and does it have pain perception? So hind limb deep pain is important to assess initially with cats with pelvic trauma, as are anal reflexes and perineal reflexes and tail-based sensations. So all the big nervous innervated areas in that caudal region of the cat. And this is because lumbar sacral plexus damage and peripheral nerve damage are actually very common. About a quarter of cats with pelvic trauma will have some degree of injury to the neurological system in this area. And it's also important to try and get this done prior to giving opioid painkillers. because that can dampen down a weakened reflex, and you may therefore think it's absent. We'll talk about these in more detail in a bit. On presentation, any animals with respiratory distress need to be treated very carefully, and I would say the best thing to do is just really observe them very carefully and probably provide them some analgesia and see if that brings down the respiratory distress. Sometimes it's pain that drives that, but other times it may be some sort of problem with the thoracic cavity or the lungs. Auscultate them if they'll tolerate it. But really try to avoid restraining any cats that that are in respiratory distress, and be very careful about sedation, if you're just trying to get some radiographs, because this can actually kill them if they're not actually suitable for it at that stage. This cat here has got let's get the pointer. It's got a diaphragmatic rupture, and there's cardiac effacement, so viscera have gone into the thoracic cavity. There's some pleural fluid as well, and although this is very clear on a radiograph, actually auscultating this cat and feeling its abdomen, you probably would be able to tell most of this without needing a radiograph at this stage. So once you've done that, then analgesia is of course very important. So you want to provide a full mu agonist if you've got it. So something like methadone, 0.1 to 0.3 mg per kg initially is usually suitable. People say about cats reacting badly to opioids, but actually if they have a source of pain, then that's not normally a problem. A partial mu agonist, which you're more likely to have in your practice, such as buprenorphine, so Vetagesic, can work very well in cats, almost as well as a full mu agonist. That's a good option. Butorphanol is not a good option, so it's not a good analgesic. It's just a good sedative. You only get about 20 minutes of analgesia from that, so that's not to be used. And you may want to sort of consider non-steroidals, but usually not within the first 24 hours. You must be sure that the animals are fully hydrated, that they haven't got any signs of hypovolemic shock, so their kidneys will be fully perfused. And you also want to ensure they haven't got any underlying renal disease. So part of your blood work is worth getting a blood urea nitrogen or a creatinine to see what their kidneys are like. And potentially even this could be pre-renal from hypovolemia leading to an increase in those. So not normally in the first 24 hours. So on presentation, we would obtain some initial blood work, and often we would repeat it at 24 hours later. We would usually take a minimum of a PCV and a total solids, ideally with a urine specific gravity, so you can tell if they are dehydrated, plus or minus a biochemistry depending on age, and plus or minus a hematology depending on whether you're trying to determine if their anemia is regenerative, etc., etc. Fatal hemorrhage is quite common in people, but not very common in cats with pelvic trauma. However, you can get significant bleeding with pelvic trauma, and occasionally these cats do need a blood transfusion or some sort of oxygen-carrying liquid such as oxyglobin, and oxyglobin obviously comes in and out of availability, and they may need this prior to anesthesia for surgery. And sometimes it's not a bad idea to actually delay surgery for a couple of days. You usually want to be operating within 5 days of a fracture, but certainly, and sooner if it's an articular fracture. But delaying a couple of days may give them chance to start to improve their anemia, if from their bleeding, if that's the case. So once you're sure that they're cardiovascularly stable, catechograms are quite useful because very quickly you can get an overarching survey of the cat and see if they've got any other injuries you potentially weren't expecting. So you can look for other fractures, spinal fractures, sacrococcygeal injuries, thoracic trauma, contusions, body wall ruptures may show up, abdominal ruptures and things like that. So can be quite useful, but they aren't suitable for surgical planning, but they're good to give you initial idea what's going on. So now we're going to talk about some of the concurrent neurological issues that you can see with pelvic fractures and pelvic trauma. So it's really important with these cats to assess hind limb deep pain and pudendal nerve reflexes at presentation, as I said to you earlier. And this really is best prior to opioid analgesics. However, if the cat is seems in extreme pain, then it's obviously essential to provide analgesia at the first step. But beware that that may then influence your interpretation of these tests. So I'd start by assessing hind limb deep pain. So I'd pinch the toes, and I'd be looking for a pain response. That's a cranial response. So the cat needs to look round or meow or something like that. And if they don't respond, then you can use something like a hemostat and apply quite a lot of pressure, because it really is important to be to know whether or not these nerves are working. A simple withdrawal reflex where the cat pulls its limb away is not the same as a deep pain response. So we need to know that they can feel the pain as well as having the spinal reflex where they move the leg. If they haven't got hind limb deep pain, this gives quite a poor prognosis. Only 50% of those cats will recover nerve function by 6 months. So it's worth knowing. I then look to assess the pudendal nerve reflexes. So these are some of the main nerve trunks that run the hind quarters of the cat. And important in urination and defecation. So when you look at these cats, their anal sphincter should be closed. If it looks gaping open, then it's probably been lacking nervation. What I normally do would be place a thermometer in the anal sphincter, and on removing it, I'd expect the anal sphincter to pucker or to wink. Other perineal reflexes are stimulation around the perineal region, so like in this diagram taken from this excellent book. So stimulation around this area should lead to sphincter contraction. And then you can make an indirect assessment of urethral sphincter and bladder tone by carefully palpating the bladder and trying some gentle manual expression. If you've got a large, difficult to express bladder, then there's probably an upper motor neuron injury. So this is some of the nerve tracts running up the spine. However, if there's a large, soft but easy to express bladder, then there's been some damage to the nervous innervation somewhere from the spine to the bladder itself. Also, when these cats present, it's worth looking at their tail tone. Have they got a mobile tail? If you gently touch it, do they move it out of the way, or is it sort of flaccid and hanging behind them? Tail base pain perception. If you take a hemostat and pinch the skin within 5 centimeters of the base of the tail, then you're looking again for a cranial response so that they look round and vocalize. So, as I said earlier, about one in four cats with pelvic trauma will have neurological deficits on presentation, and about two-thirds of those will have some sort of sciatic dysfunction, so they will have problems with their hind limb deep pain, and about a third will have what we call cauda equina, or tail pull or sacrococcygeal nerve injury. And this comes about when a traction has been applied to the tail. Often the tail can get caught underneath the wheel of a car as they're involved in the road traffic accident. And this pulls on the nerves and stretches them, and sometimes can also cause a fracture luxation. And this comes in varying degrees of severity. So they could just have a flaccid tail, but likewise, they may be urinary incontinent. And some of them will be fecal incontinent. These are difficult to manage, and the prognosis can be quite difficult to predict. But no anal tone and no tail base deep pain is a poor prognostic indicator. So if we put these tests together, if when looking at anal tone and anal reflex, if they haven't got anal tone or an anal reflex, and they can't urinate, then these cats have got a very guarded prognosis. If they have got anal tone and anal reflex and can't urinate, then it's quite likely that they may make a recovery. Cats without anal tone or perineal reflex, at 1 month after the injury are very unlikely to make a recovery. So some would consider giving a period of time of up to a month to decide what to do long term, whether they're put to sleep. However, if you're going to deal with pelvic fractures, you've got to do that before then. So difficult to manage these cases. Tail-based sensation, if it's positive, then normally get an early improvement. So in urinary tract function and tail function, and often that's days to weeks. If tail-based sensation is negative, 40% of those cats will not recover bladder function. So negative tail-based sensation is a poor prognostic indicator. If they do recover, it mostly happens by a couple of weeks on average, but can take up to a month. Tail function itself is a controversial area, as some people will advocate amputating a tail with lack of nervous function quite early on because of ongoing traction, and that's reasonable. However, it has been shown that return of tail function can take up to a month, but even or can take on average about a month, but even potentially up to half a year. So potentially you don't need to rush to perform an amputation, but it may be exacerbating their problems. So how do we manage urinary incontinence? So there's sort of options for medical management, but these are never really effective on their own and often take quite a few days to work. So normally you have to combine this with another method. For the urethral spasm, you can prescribe prazosin or phenoxybenzamine. These are both blocking alpha-1 adrenergic receptors, so they are decreasing the sympathetic tone to the urethra and therefore allowing urine flow. And to help bladder emptying, bethanacol can be used, and this helps increase the parasympathetic drive to the bladder to the detrusor muscle so that the bladder can expel. So you're going to combine this probably with either daily manual expression, and this is not ideal long term because many cats will not tolerate this and get quite upset. Indwelling catheterization is an option. Some would advocate placing the catheter, draining the bladder, and removing it rather than leaving it in place. If they're incontinent for more than 5 days, then I think a tube cystostomy is a better option. And a tube cystostomy allows long-term management. You could potentially do this for months and months and months. There's no real stress to the cat. There are risks of the tube dislodging, and if the tube dislodges, it really is a risk in the first sort of 10 to 14 days before the stoma is fused, and that could lead to uroperitoneum, so urine in the abdominal cavity. But generally, it works well and is good. I'll talk about how to do this a bit later. The thing to bear in mind is that any cat with urinary incontinence and all these management methods all do predispose them to developing urinary tract issues. And actually, sometimes that seems to help them then regain expression of their bladders. However, we would not recommend prophylactic use of antibiotics because you're increasing the chance of a resistance infection. So, really, if they get a urinary tract infection, then treat it, but don't preemptively treat with antibiotics. So tail paw injuries often combined with other injuries. This is a cat that had a tail paw injury. As you can see here, the caudal one vertebrae has been dislocated from the end of the sacrum, and you can see this quite clearly here. And if you see a radiograph like this, be very suspicious that there could be neurological cauda equina type issues. Some cats will have cauda equina issues and they won't have such an obvious dislocation. So concurrent urinary tract trauma is also quite common with pelvic fractures. If the cat has a rising blood urea nitrogen and subsequently then at rising creatinine, then you should be suspicious that this could be the case. This is also why it's worth repeating your blood work at about 24, 48 hours. And then it's worth doing an ultrasound and taking some abdominal x-rays and seeing if you can identify any free fluid, which will look black on an ultrasound, or effacement and loss of serosal detail on a radiograph, and this could be in the abdominal cavity most commonly, but it also could be in the retroperitoneal cavity around the kidneys and the ureters. If this is the case, then it's worth doing abdominocentesis, and you can then do a creatinine analysis of that fluid and compare it to blood creatinine. And if the creatinine in the fluid from the abdomen is higher than the blood, you've got leaking urinary tract. Ultrasound guided is probably best. However, you can do this blind. I'd start with the ventral right cranial quadrant, 21 gauge needle, don't connect the syringe, prep the skin, pass the needle, let the fluid drip out. And you can attach the needle and add some negative pressure if it won't come, but generally that pulls viscera onto the needle and then it stops draining. If you get nothing from that quadrant, then you can work around to the other quadrants. If they are not urinating and you've got no palpable bladder over after 12 to 24 hours, I would be suspicious of urinary tract trauma. And if you are suspicious, then you probably will have to go on to further investigations, potentially retrograde urethrocystogram or an intravenous urogram. And this is a cat which had pelvic fracture trauma, and they can quite often be quite bruised, but this is quite marked, and this bruising was actually related to urinary tract trauma. So beware hind quarter bruising like this, because it could indicate urinary tract trauma. Damage to the urethra or the bladder is the most common area of urinary tract trauma, and can be caused by the blunt trauma itself, especially if they've got a full bladder, or by, and I've seen this before, where pubic fracture fragments have actually sliced through the urethra. And you can diagnose these best with a positive contrast retrograde urethrocystogram. Small tears in the urethra can certainly be managed by an indwelling catheter, and sometimes in the bladder, if you keep the bladder deflated, then they may well heal themselves. However, bigger tears or ruptures do need surgery. Short-term management in sort of the immediate presentation, you can do repeated abdominocentesis or pass a urinary catheter, or place a peritoneal catheter, something like a Jackson Pratt, and then drain the fluid out of the abdomen. Keep them on intravenous fluids. It sounds counterintuitive, but it's important to keep the toxins diluted until you get to the point where you can actually perform definitive surgery, or you can get someone who can. Urinary diversion is usually needed if they've had major urinary tract surgery. So that's normally an indwelling urinary catheter or a tube cystostomy to keep the urine out of the system and keep the system not under pressure while it heals. Ureteric and renal leakage is uncommon. I see this very, very rarely, and would be diagnosed by an intravenous excretory urogram. And this is quite complicated to repair, so this is probably referral level, or you do a nephrectomy if you're sure that the contralateral kidney and ureter are okay. So when you're looking for pelvic fractures, you need to do a full orthopedic examination, so front legs, head, body, hind legs, everything. And it's best to do this conscious, because you can then identify areas where there might be pain or discomfort. But I will always repeat it once they're anaesthetised for radiographs or sedated, because cats can also be quite intolerant of these sorts of exams. I'd be interested to know, can they stand, can they ambulate, how much support do they need prior to considering surgery. And then it's important to carefully palpate the hindquarters. So if you feel cranially at the dorsal ileal wings, do they feel, are they symmetrical, are they at the same sort of level? And if you apply gentle pressure, are they mobile? Do they become asymmetric? Is there any crepitus? Is there any pain? I'd also make sure you manipulate each hip and put it through a full range of motion. And you can look for hip luxations aren't uncommon with pelvic fractures, so you can assess the position by feeling for the greater trochanter and looking how this relates to the opposite side and to other landmarks, which I'll talk about in a second. And if you have crepitus or pain, then you've got to consider that there could be an acetabular fracture, there could be a femoral head fracture or femoral neck fracture, are quite possible. So this is the triangle test. So if you look at this cat here, he's got a craniodorsally luxated hip, probably a sacroiliac luxation as well. That looks quite high, but the hip's dislocated. And if you look at the ischial tuber, the dorsal wing of the ilium and the greater trochanter, these all form a straight line, as I'm showing you here, whereas normally they should form a triangle. So this is a triangle test. So triangle is normal, straight line is abnormal. Obviously a ventral luxation, they can get hooked in the obturator foramen or underneath, so it will again, it won't look like this, but ventral luxations are pretty rare. So pelvic fractures are quite common, commonly seen in practice. A lot of cats get hit by cars, unfortunately, and it's not unlikely that they're going to have some sort of soft tissue injury, be it wounds, thoracic trauma, unitract trauma, nerve trauma. So here, you know, nearly two-thirds of them in surveys have that. The pelvis is a box-like structure, so it's very unusual to have one fracture without another. So in a recent survey that we did on 43 cats with pelvic fractures that we've treated, 93% of them had more than one injury, but that does include a bilateral sacroiliac luxation. So on our survey, SI luxations are the most common, followed by pubic fractures. Ischial fractures and ileal fractures are fairly similar, and least common were acetabular fractures, which is no bad thing as they are quite tricky to deal with. This cat here has got ischial fractures, hip luxation, sacroiliac luxation here, and probably some pubic fractures. Ischial tuberosity has been pulled off here, that's a urinary catheter. This cat had urinary tract injuries as well. So then you need some good radiographs for your planning. I always take thoracic radiographs in any animals that have had trauma. I take a dorsiventral thorax and a lateral thorax. I'm looking for pulmonary contusions. Sometimes they can take a couple of days to develop. Diaphragmatic ruptures, fluid, air, pneumothoraces, etc. Because this may influence how long an anaesthetic you're happy for them to have and whether or not you ventilate them during anaesthesia. And then you want to do pelvic radiographs. I would do a ventral dorsal pelvis, and I would do a frog-legged and extended, and I'll show you in a moment, as well as a lateral pelvis. And you may be considering other things, such as a retrograde study at this point, and depending on consideration of if you are suspicious of urinary tract trauma, and a CT scan, potentially. So I would always take a straight-legged VD, so the patella in the center of the femur, and I'd also take a frog leg. And the reason for this is sometimes you can get things like femoral neck fractures, which don't appear very obvious on this view, but may become more obvious on this view. So I always take both, and I'd also get a nice lateral pelvis. Occasionally, you want to oblique this, so you just separate this hemipelvis. See how it's very closely overlaid from this one, because sometimes you can't always appreciate what's going on. So I would very rarely use CT in cats for pelvic fractures, probably most useful for sacral or acetabular fractures. This is a cat with a bilateral sacroiliac luxation. So the bottom of the sacrum is here, the concomitant surface that it connects to on the ilial wing is here. So this bit here should connect to this bit here. It's like that on both sides. So bilateral SI, minimally displaced. If we look at the lateral view, this hemipelvis looks pretty low, unusual to see it like that. And we did a CT scan in this instance because we were suspicious about this, and the ilial wing had actually got lodged underneath the sacral wing. So very unusual thing to occur, but this is when CT might be useful. So 95% of the time I don't use CT when diagnosing these fractures. Then, as I said, you may be considering other advanced diagnostics such as a retrograde urethrocystogram. The best way to do this, so for male cats, is to use an IV cannula, so a blue one, take the stylet out and pass that into an extruded penis urethra, and then clamp that with a rubber tip clamp, and then administer non-diluted, non-ionic contrast, because this may obviously go into the abdomen, 2 mL/kg, but be very careful. And as you can see in this cat, it's got a urethral rupture, and this cat's got a bladder rupture with contrast leaking out in and around the the jejunum, small intestines. So this is probably more common to do retrograde than an IVU, intravenous urogram, 2 mL/kg again of non-ionic iohexol. However, this is given intravenously, and then you take radiographs at 3, 5, 10, and 15 minutes, lateral and ventridorsal, and you will see different phases. So initially you'll see it in the vasculature, then you'll see it in the nephrons, nephrogram phase, and then you'll be in the collecting the into the ureter, and you'll see potential like here. This is your ureteric leakage. Uncommon, but can happen. So when are pelvic fractures surgical or not? So this is not a definitive, but this is some rules of thumb. So if there's a fracture of the weight-bearing axis, so this would include the hip joint or the acetabulum, the ilium and the sacroiliac joint and the sacrum. So these probably may need surgery, and articular, so acetabular fractures would also be included in this. If there are multiple injuries, so more than one hind limb has been compromised or more than one half of the cat, if there is significant pelvic canal narrowing, so we're looking from here to here, this has been narrowed more than 50%, then you probably need to consider surgery. In the study that we did, we didn't see any megacolon from narrowing, but the narrowing was never greater than 50%. If the cat is in extreme pain because the sciatic nerve is damaged or caught, then that's an indication of surgery. If you've tried conservative management and they're still not walking by about 3 to 4 days, then you've got to get in there and probably operate. And instead, in that retrospective of 43 cats we did, most of them had surgery, and about 22% of those did develop complications, but most of them were mild transient sciatic neuropraxia, and this resolved. And this is related to the fact you're operating in and around the sciatic nerve. Long-term outcome was excellent, and most had a full recovery. So it is a good thing to do when appropriately chosen. So not surgical. Okay, so you've got a unilateral sacroiliac luxation and it's under 50% displaced, you could potentially leave that, especially if they're ambulatory. Non-weight-bearing pelvic fractures, so pelvic floor fractures, don't normally need surgery, unless they're narrowing the canal. Minimally displaced acetabular fractures, we'll come on to that a bit later, potentially you could leave. Ischial fractures are normally left unless they're very displaced. And potentially, you know, if the other option is the cat's going to be put to sleep, then probably they should all get a chance at conservative management. Conservative management isn't easy though. You're looking at 6 to 8 weeks of very strict cage rest. I would normally radiograph them a few days after your initial diagnosis, just to make sure that the fracture fragments aren't starting to move around, that everything's reasonably stable. You need to get them a large cage which can fit a litter box and have an area for food, and you've got to consider analgesics, which is normally non-steroidals. So we're going to talk about some specific fracture types now. So sacroiliac fracture luxations or luxations, commonly a result of blunt hind trauma, and I say are really common. Previous studies have said about 60% of pelvic fractures have it, but we got up to 93%, and these are from digital radiographs, potentially more detailed. And this cat here has got a 100% sacroiliac luxation, that should be down here, and also a fracture of the ilium. So I'd say they're often combined with another injury or the other SI is gone. So like this case, two injuries because the pelvis is a square box. When do you operate, when don't you? If they're bilateral, I would operate. If they are unilateral and under 50% displaced, so there's an overlap up to about here, then you could consider leaving them. However, if one side is like this, but not as displaced, but the other side's got a fracture, then I would probably operate. Most of the time you're placing a lag screw. You may add a transileal pin, but sometimes that can be used as an alternative. So this is a mild sacroiliac luxation. So you see here that this point here should meet the curve here. So it's a little bit displaced here. I think we've got, yep, here we go. So show you here. So that point there should join to there. But it's bilateral, so I would certainly fix one side, if not both. In this instance, we've got about a 50% sacrum comes from here to here, and this is about 50% displaced. And then the other side, there's a fracture through the ileal wing. You can see that here. Here's the fracture. And this cat is unbelievable, really. So this is the wing of the ileum. This should be articulating here. So this is totally rotated out. This one is also quite luxated. And actually, it's very rare you actually see the articular surface on the ileal wing that should normally butt up to the sacrum. So it's got a very bad ischial fracture down here, ischial pubic fracture, which is floated off. Really bad fracture. And this cat on initial viewing might look like it's fine, but the sacrum is here. So this area should be level to here, whereas actually it's in line with L7 in this case. So this cat has sort of been shunted from behind, leading to the whole pelvis moving forwards. So for surgery, some people operate on these cats in sternal. I prefer to do them in lateral, and then I will stand on this side, so behind them, and your positioning is very important. You want them to be totally square to the table. You then make a dorsal approach. This book is excellent for surgical approaches. Here's some pictures taken from it. A dorsal approach, and you palpate the ileal wing and incise directly over it. In dogs, you get a really nice fascial separation between the middle gluteal and the sacrospinalis. In cats, the muscle sort of rolls over, so you've got to keep feeling the bone and continue to make your incision. This is a cat that's had a screw put in, and you can see the approach there, but we've opened this up quite a lot to get down for a second fracture. You need to be careful moving cordially because the sciatic nerve comes hooping around here. Then you want to retract the ileal wing. So what normally I would do is I'd put a small homen underneath and lever the ileal wing ventrally. Be careful as you place the homen because there are nerves under here and you can trap them. And then you need to drill a pilot hole through the sacrum. This is in a different position to the dog, so don't, if you know the landmarks for a dog, don't use them. It's different in a cat. What you need to do is to imagine this as a circle, right here. And then find the center of this circle, and then the hole, the pilot hole, is actually slightly dorsal to this center. Sometimes there's a small divot here you can feel, and the other way is look at it. This area here has got articular cartilage, semilunar cartilage ring, and it's usually just sitting in the sort of the middle of that. The screw wants to be at least 60% across the sacrum. I'll pre-measure the sacrum on the ventral dorsal radiograph so I know kind of what I'm aiming for. And that minimises the chance of screw loosening. So if you hit 60%, 90% of screws won't loosen. And obviously as you get further across, the loosening decreases. And this shows you where your start point. So this is our start point here. And this is slap bang in the middle of this area here. And this is important because if you go, if you deviate dorsally, you're going to get into the neural canal and you could damage the caudal equinus, you could cause nerve damage. And if you deviate ventrally, there's actually a artery and vein here. Ventrally, I less worry about than dorsally. Dorsally, you really want to avoid, but ideally, you want to be in the middle of this area here. They need to place a glide hole in the ileal wing. So this pelvis has had the sacrum taken out. This is the surface that articulates with the sacrum. And if you get a small towel clamp, and you can actually sort of palpate sort of the divot here where you want to concomitantly place your hole. So you'll fill that. And other landmarks you can use if you go from cranial to dorsal aspect of the dorsal surface of the ileal wing, about 70% of that distance, which is about here. So this hole is actually a little bit too caudal. I think the hole should be about here, is about right. And then along this gluteal insertion line, you can't see it that clearly. See this sort of where the light shines here? That's the line you want to place it along. And the glide hole should obviously be big enough for the screw to pass through. And this hole needs tapping, or you need a pilot hole needs tapping, or you place a self-tapping screw. I most commonly use a 2mm screw or a 2.4. Some people use 2.7. I feel most comfortable with these, and I don't have particular problems with the screws loosening, so I think that's fine. And if they're very young cats, then you should place a washer underneath the screw head, because otherwise the screw can actually travel through this and cheese wire straight through the hole that you've made. Here we are, here's the finished product. So there's the screw in place holding the sacrum back in place. So this is the radiograph I showed you earlier with the ileal wing fracture, 50% sacroiliac luxation. So this is a very unusual fracture. Normally they fracture along here. And this cat had bilateral SI screws. So this screw has gone through probably nearly 100% of the distance. We've got two of them, one from each side. You can see from here that they're both within the body of the sacrum. They're not gone into the neural canal, and they've not exited dorsally. And these couple of KYs just holding this little fragment together as well. So transileal pins is an alternative method to deal with this. They're quite good for unilateral sacroiliac luxations. You can use them for bilateral, preferably if one side has had a lag screw, because this increases stability and helps you with your reduction. You can use them for bilateral sacroiliac luxations, but not ideal. You're probably going to be using a 1.2 to 1.6 millimeter K wire. I do position cats for this in sternal, and then I do mini approaches over the dorsal iliac spines. And then this is the area that you're looking at. So you want to get it in this piece of ileal wing above the lamina of the lumbar vertebrae. So above this, sometimes you will get the spinous process and you're passing a pin from side to side. Quite helps put a pair of reduction forceps across first and then drive your pin and then bend the ends over each side. Here are some examples. Transileal pin. This is a bolt. Another transileal pin, and this is transileal pin with a SI lag screw as well. Ileal fractures are common. About 50% of cats with pelvic fractures will have these. They're usually surgical. This is because they affect the weight-bearing axis, or they can lead to narrowing. Most commonly, we place a plate on the lateral aspect of the ilium. You can place one dorsally. You can place both. And most commonly I use DCPs, but some might use VCPs or LCPs. An X-fix is reported. I've never done that, not commonly used. And if you've got a long oblique fracture, you may get away with lag screws only, but I would tend to combine with a plate. So about half of these fractures are oblique, and about a quarter transverse, and a quarter have some comminution. I said lateral plating are most common, and you're probably looking at a 2 mm DCP, and you want three screws either side. And if it's a transverse fracture, you can compress the fracture. So something like this, and this is a real example. And the surgical approach is a gluteal roll-up. So what you do is you have the cat in lateral, you palpate from the crane aspect of the ileal wing to the crestus canter, make a skin incision, then through the fat, and then you open up the gluteal fascia, and then you undermine the middle gluteal and roll it upwards, hence the gluteal roll up. And again, this book is very good for this. You often find that the caudal fragment has sort of disappeared medially. It's quite difficult to find. If you make a small stab incision over the ischial tuberosity, which you can palpate, and then use a small kern or a towel clamp or a forceps, you can then use this to pull the fragment back. You could also use the hip. So you can use the femur and pull this fragment into line. Some will contour a plate beforehand from radiographs or specimen pelvis and then autoclave it. This decreases surgical time. I don't tend to do that. And some fractures, such as, so this one here has got a oblique fracture and there's two lag screws and a plate. This one here was a three-piece. There's a piece in the middle, another piece here. So I stabilized them with KYs and then put a sort of reconstruction plate so I could bend it around. This is 2.7. And this one here, again, oblique fracture. Two KYs, stable it while we placed a plate. So lateral plating for ileal fractures have a reported screw loosening rate of up to 62%, as shown here from this paper from Michael Hamilton. Anecdotally, I've really not seen this that commonly. They suggested that there isn't very good bone stock from medial to lateral in the ilium, and I would agree that the bone stock is poorer in the cranial ileal wing. And this is something I was involved in. So we looked at dorsal plating. So cats have got a very straight ilial wing. Dogs, it curves round, so they don't really lend themselves to this, but you can actually put a plate on the dorsal surface. And this gives you quite improved bone stock because the bone quality is thicker in the dorsal and ventral cortex. But the surgery is more difficult. But although it looks like the screws will be difficult to pass, they actually tend to glide down the medial and lateral walls of the ilium. So not too bad, but the surgical approach is more difficult. And here's an example. So this is a dorsal approach. So it's not a nice approach. It's a bit like the sacroiliac approach, but you extend it further. Got to watch out for the sciatic nerve when it comes up. This is the oblique fracture, and then this is it with a dorsal plate and screws in place. Sometimes ilial fractures are very short, so they may be somewhere in this region close to the acetabulum, and these are called cotyloid fractures. And something like a 2 millimeter T plate can be quite good, so worth considering these if you've got a short fracture fragment. Double plating like this is unusual, so we've used them sometimes when you haven't got, so there's a lot of comminution in this area, you can't get three screws, so we've got two screws on this plate and two screws on this plate. So we've got sufficient numbers of screws now by doing double plating. And this was a fracture that we was referred in for revision, and plating, we replaced this lateral plate that failed and then put a second plate on as well to augment it. Acetabular fractures occur in about a quarter of pelvic fractures, and they can be difficult to diagnose sometimes. So sometimes oblique lateral views can help, so because the superimposition can sometimes obscure the fracture, and likewise CT can help with these if you have it. And animals under 6 months old will have a tridiaphysis, so it's a line like this that runs down, so be careful of that. They are articular fractures, so you need perfect reduction and rigid internal fixation. We used to say that fractures in the caudal third were not weight-bearing. This has been biomechanically disproved, so you do need to consider repairing the fractures in the caudal one third. So what are your options for acetabular fractures? So if they're minimally displaced and simple, then you could repair them, or you could conservatively manage the cat, let it heal, and then do a femoral head and neck excision at a later stage if the cat's painful. If they're minimally displaced and simple, and it's the caudal rim, and by that I mean right along this edge, then probably I would leave them because the surgical approach is quite invasive, and you're probably not going to improve things that much. But they need to be right on this edge, not in the acetabulum, but just along that edge, and you do see those from time to time. And if that they don't do well, then femoral head and neck excision later. If they're displaced and simple, then they need a repair or a femoral head and neck excision. And sometimes you have to do that and stabilize the pelvis because of the pelvic canal can narrow, but doesn't have to obviously be perfectly opposed. And if it's comminuted, then probably a femoral head and neck excision. Total hip replacement is an option once the acetabulum is healed, but it's very challenging. So acetabular fractures are challenging because of their anatomy. So this here is a sciatic nerve right in the middle of this acetabular fracture. Surgical cases, the access is difficult. So the common approach is the craniolateral approach, but it only really gives you to the cranial third. So if you've got to go round to plate something, then you need a caudodorsal. And certainly anything that's mid to caudal in the acetabulum needs a caudodorsal approach. And a caudodorsal approach is quite invasive. We've either got to do gluteal tenotomies, as you see here, so all the gluteal muscles have been cut and tagged so I can reattach them, or you need to take off the top of trochanter. And I must admit, I tend to do this in dogs and tend to do gluteal tenotomies in cats. So you start with a cranial approach, which is, I don't really have time to go through that in this lecture, and then you develop this into the caudal dorsal. So here we've got the forceps underneath the middle gluteal muscle, which is then going to get transected and tagged. And then the repair is important, something like a locking loop where you pass a suture through and around, through and around, and through and around. So you actually form a box with these corners that grab tissue. So, and you want to use something like PDS, a long-lasting monofilament absorbable material. Articular fractures should have compression, but this can be problematic because a lot of the plates that we use in this area, because the anatomy is difficult, don't allow compression. You want to get good reduction, anatomic reduction, and your options are a straight plate. I rarely use these for these. You can place screws with a tension band wire and polymethyl methacrylate. You can use these custom acetabular plates. I use these sometimes. Reconstruction plates like these, which can be contoured. String of pearls are quite good, and they've got locking screws. Or you can go for a femoral head and neck incision or a total hip replacement. So here we've got a cat ilial fracture, lateral plate, acetabular plate here. And their subplates come in different sizes depending on what you need. And this also had a SI screw. And this cat had acetabular fracture, which was paired with, so you place a screw, another screw, often with a washer, and there's a piece of orthopedic wire that's been twisted and tightened in a figure of eight, and then this is all set in polymethyl methacrylate, and this actually creates tension and compresses the fracture. Reasonable option in cats, and it's got transilial pins as well. Femoral head and neck incision is a good option in cats, I think. Can be used for failed acetabular repair if they get arthritis, for non-reconstructable acetabular fractures, if you've got cost considerations, or if the owner won't tolerate potential complications. This has a pretty low complication rate. You need to do a cranial lateral approach to the hip, and then you need to do a head and a neck. So often people are inclined to make a cut like this, but you actually need to take the cut down and remove the whole neck segment, and that will minimize any catching. Oscillating saw, like in this picture, is best, but you can use giggly wire and osteotoma mallet, and this is sort of the trajectory that you're looking at. Once you've removed it, review what you've got. So you want a nice straight cut, you don't want spurs, feel the edge of the femur, and check that you've got a big piece of neck here as well. Excuse me. And check for any crepitus and move the leg and make sure it's okay. If it's not okay, go back, recut, remove spurs, file any sharp edges. Then you want to suture the joint capsule closed, often pre-place sutures, and again check range of motion and crepitus. Then close muscle, sub-Q, and skin sequentially. And again, I always keep checking range of motion. I use a slowly absorbable suture materials. You may be familiar with muscular slings, so people put a piece of muscle in between the femoral, the cut side of the femur and the acetabulum, but this is not recommended as it increases time and morbidity and hasn't been shown to improve outcomes. So this is a cat which came out of theatre. This cut is insufficient, so it was recut, and you can see here, this is a better cut. You don't want this spur sticking out here. And then after 14 days of rest, they need lots of exercise because to form a good pseudoarthrosis, they need to be exercising. Total hip replacement, like in this cat, usually cemented femoral and acetabular component. You can get these very small micro hips for cats. They can be very challenging if you've had a previous fracture, so definitely referral. So complications from pelvic fractures, about 22% will get postoperative complications, but most of these are postoperative cystic neuropraxia. So there may be some knuckling or weakness after surgery, and this is because you've been stretching the sciatic nerve when you repair ilial acetabular fractures by moving the fracture fragments back. But it improves in all cats and usually resolves. Implant failure we saw in 6%. But that's some screw loosening, but none required any revision. An infection, that was one cat, so 3%. Again, a little bit high, but that's because the numbers in the group were only 43, so we'd expect infection rate to be about 1.5 to 2% only after any type of orthopedic surgery where implants are placed. Constipation was reported in 19% of cats, but it wasn't an ongoing problem. Megacolon is something that people talk about a lot. So this is a cat with megacolon, and it had quite marked pelvic canal malformation from a previous fracture. And 25% of megacolon cats are said to be due to prior pelvic fractures. However, our study didn't show any cats with megacolon. We had a mean follow-up of 2 years and went up to nearly 5 years or 4 years. However, all the cats in our study only had a narrowing of under 50%, whether they're conservatively managed or operatively managed. So we, no cats had a greater than 50%. So if it is greater than 50% and they need surgery, I would still say the recommendation. Post-op, a rough guide, usually 7 to 10 days of non-steroidals. We don't normally give post-operative antibiotics, but we will give perioperative antibiotics unless they've got open fractures or open non-granulated wounds. They normally need cage rest up until the point of follow-up radiographs, which is normally 6 to 8 weeks. And I would say the cats can come out of their cage for supervised time, 5 minutes, three times a day, for the first week, first 2 weeks, and then increase that by 5 minutes every 2 weeks. So by the time they come back, they're normally doing about 15 minutes, three times a day. Check at 5 to 7 days, and suture removal at 10 to 14 days. And you may need to take a second set of radiographs at 12 to 16 weeks if you're not happy about the level of healing that you're seeing. Outcome from pelvic fractures is good to excellent with appropriately chosen conservative and surgical management. The cats had neurological deficits at the outset from their trauma. 50% had resolved by their re-exam at 6 to 8 weeks. 80% had resolved by 6 months, and all of the cats had improved. So the outcome looks pretty good, really. No megacolon was seen, and no revision surgery was required. 86% of cats after pelvic fractures have no lameness. But the remainder may have a mild degree of impairment. So now we're going to talk about placing a tube cystostomy. So it's a soft tissue procedure, but very useful with pelvic fractures if there's urinary incontinence. So do a ventral midline celiotomy, but make it quite caudal, and then locate the bladder. And if you move it over to the left abdominal wall, see where it sits. And at that point is where you want to then make a puncture in the abdominal wall, so pass a forceps through the abdominal wall and then cut over the top with a hemostat, with a scalpel, and then pass your hemostat through. And then you're usually using, I tend to use silicon Foleys, 8 to 14 French for these, but you can use a mushroom-tipped Depeza catheter and pull that through into the abdominal cavity. Then you really want to get the cranial pole of the bladder and place a stay suture so you can manipulate the bladder, and then put the bladder back to that position where this tube's coming through. Look at where it's going to sit. Normally this is sort of ventral lateral, but fairly ventral. Obviously beware of the dorsal surface because the ureters enter there. And place a purse string around the area in to make the incision, and then make a stab incision through that. Pass the tube into the bladder and then inflate your Foley and tighten the purse string. And then you need to pull the tube through the abdominal wall, and this will and guide the bladder to the abdominal wall. And then you're going to place four sutures, one dorsally underneath, one to this side, and then one ventrally. So you form a box. So we call it a box pexy. So four interrupted sutures, usually something like PDS, so slow absorbable monofilament. We do that to ensure that you get a nice pexy form, so that if or when you remove the tube or if the tube gets dislodged, this is a seal between the bladder and the abdominal wall, and you're not going to get leakage into the abdominal cavity. Then you want to ensure that there's urine flow through the tube and connects to a sealed connecting set that's sterile. Close the abdomen and place a Chinese finger trap to secure the tube. The tubes need to stay in for at least 10 days because of the stoma needs to form prior to removal. You can empty the collecting bag of every, or you can empty the bladder by connecting a syringe to the tube 4 to 3 times daily. And then when it comes to removal, deflate the Foley and it should just drop out usually and remove the finger trap. Cover with a sterile dressing and allow to heal by second intention. They don't normally need suturing closed. And that's it. If you've got any questions, I'm happy to answer them. So I've got a couple of questions here. So I've been asked, when you're placing a SI lag screw, what do you do if the sacrum is also fractured? And yeah, this does happen from time to time, and this is pretty challenging actually. What I suggest you do is you clear as much of the side of the sacrum as you can. And sometimes you can make an educated guess as to where the rest of the sacrum would have been if it's only part fractured, and then you can still work out your landmarks. If you have access to fluoroscopy, that could be an option. However, quite often, if this is the case, then I may consider going straight to a transilial pin. I hope that answered your question. And actually, it seems this is quite an interesting area. So I've got my second question here is what should you do if you place the screw within the neural canal? I guess first of all, you need to be sure that that's what you've done. So I would take some oblique radiographs, and really what you want to try and do is get a radiograph such that the head of the screw is totally covering the body of the screw, so it looks like just a dot, and then you know exactly where the screw is. CT is also an option, but if you do think it is in that space, then I would remove the screw. And then, but take the x-rays that you've taken with you when you go back to theatre and use those and use the original hole that you made with the screw in it to guide your placement of a second screw. If the screw's gone ventrally, I would probably leave it as long as you've got some sort of stability across the sacrum. And I think it's probably quite important to carefully assess the next day for neurological function. If this does happen, they're often okay, but it can cause some problems sometimes. Okay, well, I think if that's it then, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed the webinar and you found it informative and helpful.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Richard for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.